fit in here. The first one showed up in my box yesterday, and I really don't know that it has anything to do with this class. Probably more this class than any, but I suspect maybe it came about based on some of the comments made in the sermons yesterday about worship and so forth. So this is for all of you doodlers. Is it okay to doodle or draw during church service? What if it helps you pay attention to the lesson? I know what I think, but I want your opinion. Translated, no matter what you say, I'm going to keep doing it. I can honestly say I've never gotten that question before, but I'm not a doodler. So maybe I just can't relate to this, but I'll give you my answer. I would have answered this one privately, but I don't know who submitted it. If it helps you concentrate, there might be a sliver of spiritually redeeming value in it, but it's pretty hard for me to find the sliver. Anytime I try to do more than one thing, and we all do, my focus is not as good as if I was simply trying to do one thing, whether it's talk on my cell phone or change the dial on the radio. So I guess my feeling is, assuming this was an adult or someone, well, it's someone old enough to write a note, I would discourage it for two reasons. Number one, I question whether it really helps you concentrate. Now, maybe it helps you stay awake, but there'd be other ways to do that. And secondly, when I see someone doodling and drawing, the first thing that comes to my mind is they are really encapsulated with what's going on in the service. So that's my opinion. Does anybody want to doodle? Dave?
It's not my question, but if you doodle in the right way, it adds greatly to the way it imprints the message on the brain.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Michelangelo, Da Vinci, John F. Kennedy, they were all great doodlers.
I remember a few years ago at one of these meetings, Dave appeared to be doodling, and he informed me that that was a systematic way of taking notes. And I believed him. I didn't understand it, but I believed him because I trusted him. But in general, most of our doodling is not that academically sophisticated.
Call it mind map.
Okay. So if whoever submitted this wants more of my opinion, I'll be here. Did someone else have a comment on this one? It didn't really fit into any of my future lessons this week, so I thought I'd just address it. Another one, and then we'll move on, I think probably came from our discussion on delegation. When the elders are asking or suggesting that its members do something, shouldn't that be considered as something the member should do instead of the officer's desires? And I would agree with that. Whenever we delegate as leaders, we ought to be delegating something that not only do we think the person would be good at, but maybe it would be good for them to do, as opposed to just something we want done. Now, there may be times when it's not the most pleasant task and it just needs to be done, and our officers might ask us to help, and we should be willing to do that. But it should be something productive and something that probably should be done anyway. Okay, I'm going to take about 5 or 10 minutes and recap last week, because we've got new people here and it's been 3 days since we did this, and so a lot's happened, and then I'll move on to some other things. So these first few PowerPoints are recaps of last week. And I define leadership as influence. If you influence somebody, you are exerting a form of leadership. You can be a bad leader, you can be a good leader, you can be a great leader. What you cannot be is a non-leader. Now, I would often, and probably you, would prefer not to be a leader. I just don't consider it to be an option. Someone is always leading. Good, bad, great, but someone is always leading. And that was kind of our thematic opening slide last week. On Tuesday, we talked about courage being an important part of leadership. On Wednesday, we talked about delegation being an important part of leadership. On Thursday, we talked about communication and listening, in particular, being an important part of leadership. And on Friday, we discussed various styles of leadership that can be implemented in the home, in the church, and in any setting, really. Under courage, I used a quote by Ambrose Redmond: courage is not the absence of fear, but rather the judgment that something else, parentheses is my words, serving God, is more important than fear. So courage, as Christian leaders, is not that we aren't trepidatious and sometimes scared, because that's the humanness in us. We just have to put serving God ahead of that. We talked about Joseph of Arimathea, how it took courage for him to go in and ask for the body of Jesus, when undoubtedly he would have been setting himself up for ridicule, if not some persecution from his peers. We talked about Gideon in Judges chapter 6 and 7 and 8, how that he started out as a rather trepidatious leader, but by the end of those chapters we find him exerting some courage, and I submit becoming a better leader. Great Christian leaders must have courage to lead as the Lord directs. And you aren't going to do that unless you exhibit some courage. Under delegation, we discussed how that was a battle of trust over control. In order to be a great leader, you have to be willing to delegate. And in order to delegate, you have to trust and believe in the people around you. If you are a control freak, you will have difficulty delegating. If you're just control-oriented, you will have difficulty delegating. And to the extent you and I are, we will not be great Christian leaders. We talked about the example of Moses and Jethro. And this was brought up yesterday afternoon. A classic example in Exodus 18 of delegation. We talked about Nehemiah and him delegating the various aspects of building the wall around Jerusalem. And we looked at Nehemiah chapter 3. It's better to put 1,000 men to work than try to do the work of 1,000 men. Well, you can't do the work of 1,000 men. But even if you could, I submit it would be better to put 1,000 men to work. All great leaders delegate. I don't see any way around that. We talked about the benefits of delegating. There's benefits for the person who delegates because they can move on to tasks that maybe they can do that others can't do. There's the benefit for the entire body because its needs are met more efficiently. And there is the benefit to the person who is being asked to do the work because they can grow. And we talked about the concept of how much should you delegate. And I used the phrase, delegate till they squeal. And by that we meant delegate until you find the limits of what someone can do and then back off a little bit. But until you find those limits, you'll never know how much they can handle. Under communication, George Bernard Shaw said, the greatest problem with communication is the illusion that it's been accomplished. Many times we feel we have articulated to somebody what's very clear to us, and it may not be clear to them, or they may have heard something quite different than what we thought we were saying. We talked about the importance of listening as a leader. It may be more important than speaking. We used the example of Rehoboam. And again, I think Ed touched on this in his lesson yesterday afternoon, how he finally, after not listening to the wise advice, did listen a little bit later in his life to the Lord. We talked about how questions can bring more understanding than answers. Well, obviously we need the answers, but I find it's the questions that cause us to dig. Under leadership styles, we talked about five. Autocratic, which is pretty much a dictatorial approach. Bureaucratic, which is the finding of a set of rules, and then everybody adheres to them, and as long as we all adhere to the rules, everything works fine. Permissive, this is keep everybody happy, and kind of a laissez-faire type of an approach. We had the hands-off, or I kind of tongue-in-cheek call it the Republican approach. Less is better. Less leadership is better. And in some times of peace, that can be true. And the participatory. This is when the concept is the more the flock, in the case of a church, gets to participate in decision-making, the more effective the work of the church will be. And again, that's probably mostly true in times of peace and harmony. But we concluded, or at least I concluded, that it could be what works best for one person might not work best for another. In other words, one leader might find one style to be more effective. But what I really meant by that is that is as a leader directs different people that he might have influence over, the same style is not always going to work. If a false teacher comes in and tries to take over the pulpit, I want a very autocratic leader who puts a stop to that. I don't want someone stand up and say, okay, congregation, let's vote on whether this guy keeps talking. No, those things aren't voted on. But there are other times when, in a participatory mode, we get more buy-in, we get more commitment by people to work on the task. And I think there are congregational differences. What might be best suited at a certain time for one congregation might not be what's best suited for another congregation. Who might be an effective elder in one congregation might not be an effective elder in another congregation. I'm not talking about compromising the qualifications. I'm just talking about the chemistry and the dynamics and how people work together. Another way of basically saying the same thing. Okay, I think that's all I had on review. Does anybody have a comment, a question on anything you might have thought of from last week, or maybe some you weren't here and you just want to understand one of those bullet points before I start moving on to some new material? Okay, for those of you that weren't with us last week, and to remind those of you who were, I said I did not plan on going to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1 and spending a lot of time going down the qualifications of officers. Not because they're not important, they are exquisitely important. I just think that many, if not all of you, have gone over those, and when your congregation considers officers, I hope and I trust your congregation will review them. So having said I'm not going to do that, let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1. Because I have had a few questions, and what I'm going to do is just comment on four of them that I get asked most often about. This is your chance to ask about any of them, but I will comment on four of them that I get asked most about. Maybe they're not the ones you get asked about. They're not very long. I mean, these texts aren't very long, so with your patience, I'm going to read them, and then we'll go back just to refresh our memory, and then I'll comment on the ones that I would like to, and then allow you to comment on those or on any of the others. First of all, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and I think you're familiar that this is where we get some of the qualifications for elders, and we get a commentary on deacon qualifications. 1 Timothy chapter 3, this is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop, and I hope we all understand that that's the same as presbytery or elder, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetousness, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? The elder is not to be a novice, verse 6, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Now he moves to the deacon. Verse 8. Likewise must the deacons be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre, holding the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience, and let these also first be proved, then let them use the office of deacon, being found blameless. Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderous, sober, faithful in all things. Let the deacons be husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own homes well, houses well. For they that have used the office of a deacon well purchased to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. I'll turn now to Titus chapter 1 and read verses 5 through 11. Titus 1, verse 5. Paul says to Titus, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things which are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I have appointed you. If any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly, let the bishop, for a bishop, must be blameless, as a steward of God, not self-willed, not soon angry, not given to wine, no striker, not given to filthy lucre, but a lover of hospitality, a lover of good men, sober, just, holy, temperate, holding fast the faithful word which he hath been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince or convict the gainsayer. For there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses, teaching things which they ought not for filthy lucre's sake." I'm going to comment on the four that I'd like to, but I'll pause at the end of each of these four so that if you have a comment on that, then after I've commented on those four, if you have comments or questions about any of the others, this would be a good time for us to consider that. The first one is found in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1, and I'm in the King James. "This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop." What does it mean that it's when it says it's good for a man to desire the office? My best understanding of that is this is to be a desire to serve the Lord, and if we have an ability in this area, we are qualified in this area, and the congregation wants us to serve, we are willing to serve. Our desire is to serve. Our desire is not for preeminence. Our desire is not for prestige. I don't believe this is the connotation of a man running for the office or campaigning for the office. And I would say to you men, if you are not officers, you need to be careful in this. I don't think it's wrong to let people know that that's one of your goals, but if you're not careful, you can set your congregation up into thinking, well, if we don't put him in, he's going to be terribly disappointed, and we don't want to hurt his feelings. Well, that is about as bad a reason for putting anybody into the office as I can think of. And I don't know that that would be the intent that we do. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to let people know where we're wanting to work toward that. I've had a couple of people, men, come up to me last week and said, "Tell me what I need to do. Tell me how I can grow so that I can be an officer." Well, I didn't give them very, very good answers. First of all, because I don't know that there is a real good answer, but I'm awful hesitant to even give those answers for this reason. I might pick out two or three things that I think that person should work on. Well, that's good, but they go work on those two or three things, and then they have this expectation that now they're going to be appointed. Well, maybe I only mentioned two or three, and the congregation knows four or five, so they could be setting themselves up for disappointment. Just serve the Lord exemplary to the best of your ability, and the congregation will recognize it if they've got the Lord in their heart. But this desire, I think, is a desire to serve, not the desire to have the preeminence of the office. Probably very self-explanatory, but I'll pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question about that, or maybe you've seen something that would trigger a thought there. Okay. Husband of one wife. What does that mean? Well, that's been kind of a diving board for all kinds of positions. Could an elder have been married before? Must an elder be married? Well, let's take care of the second one first. Yes. An elder must be married when he is appointed. Now, there is a gray area, and I'll give you my opinion on this. These are qualifications for the appointment of an elder. I would never appoint a man to the office who isn't married. And I don't think any of our evangelists here would do that. Maybe I'm pretty confident in saying that. But there are cases, and you can all think of them as I can, where a man has lost his wife while he is an elder. Now what do we do? Well, the bottom line is, as far as I can tell, the scriptures are completely silent about it. So we have to use our best judgment. I do not believe if a man is an elder and his wife dies, he is automatically mandated to resign the eldership. But I know men and I know congregations who feel that way, and if that's the way they feel, that's the way they should proceed. And I have seen some men that should resign because it just throws them for a loop or whatever, and they're no longer quite the same man they used to be. I have seen other men that are able to assimilate that and continue on, and the congregation is comfortable with it. And so I am comfortable with it because the Bible doesn't tell me contrary. It's probably no different than if a man has children and, God forbid, all of his children are killed in a car wreck. Does that make him less qualified? Well, I think the qualification has to do with having learned how to deal with the home. And if one has learned how to deal with the home, then I think that doesn't go away just because there has been a death. Now, go a little bit further on this. Are there exceptions to simply being the husband of one wife? Well, I think you've probably studied this enough to know that the literal here is a one-woman man is what's being said. I think this is probably number one saying he must be married, and number two, it's an admonition against polygamy. I doubt any of us would disagree that if a man has lost his wife through death and then remarries, if it's a scriptural remarriage, that would not knock him out of being considered for an elder. And I have appointed at least one man who falls into that category. His wife died of cancer. He remarried a couple of years later, a year or so after that. The congregation was comfortable and we were able to put him in as an elder. I did that without any trepidation of my conscience, and I stand by that until somebody can show me that that is not an appropriate way to do. But that's not really where the question comes, is it? The question comes when a man's been divorced. If a man has been divorced, even, let's say his wife left him for another person, he has all rights to remarry, as I understand Scripture, and I think Charles touched on this a little bit. I don't know if he'll go there again or not, but perfectly legitimate biblical right to remarry. And now we think, can we put him in as an officer? Because this husband of one wife applies to both elder and deacon. Well, I have never done that. And as I stand here today, as I currently think, I probably never will. Now, having said that, I'm not convinced that by the letter of the law, that man is automatically disqualified if he has the right to remarry. But I probably would not do it because I think that it could be terribly unwise, even though possibly permissible. And some of you will disagree that it's permissible. And some of you might even disagree that it would be unwise. But there are so many things that an elder and a deacon deal with in a family way with other families that to have that thrown up to them seems to me like it would almost be unfair to the man to put himself in that position. That's my first reason. My second reason is it's a little gray for me. And when it's a little gray, I think this is an area where I'd like to stay away from it and take the cautious approach. Now, that is too bad. in one sense, because I know several men that I now think would probably, in my humble opinion, make great elders had it not been for a situation earlier in their lives. But it's hard to undo that. So I've given you what I think the scripture says, and I'm also now giving you my opinion, for which you can disagree. I know of some elders in the churches that we fellowship who have been divorced and remarried, and there may be one that doesn't fit this, but the ones I'm thinking of, it happened prior to their conversion to the Lord, which helps me a little bit. But I think this is an area where I want to be very cautious. So I have never done that, and unless my thinking changes, I probably never will, even though my heart aches because we need good men so bad that it's hard to pass up a good man for any reason. But that's what I believe. I'll open it up for questions or comments. Bunch of brave souls. Okay, that's fine. I'm happy to move on. The third one has to do with faithful children. And in Titus it talks about, in the King James it uses the phrase, that the elder should have faithful children. In some translations, I was looking at the English Standard last night, it says believing children. And I didn't check it, but I want to say the NIV may say that also. In 1 Timothy 3, it doesn't really speak in those terms. It talks about having his children in subjection with all gravity. Well, obviously, we would prefer all of our officers to have all of their children in the church. But we would like for all of our members to have all of their children in the church. I mean, is that the ideal? Absolutely. My personal belief, and in Titus, I think the word for faithful there is pistis, or from that root, which means to have faith. The problem in Titus, well, not the problem, but the area that I question is it doesn't say faithful to whom. It just says faithful children. Is that faithful to the Lord, or is it faithful to their parents? When I couple that with 1 Timothy chapter 3, where it says having his children in subjection with all gravity, that phrase seems to me to be under the subjection of the father, under the subjection of the parent. So my personal belief is this is talking about having children that are faithful and trustworthy to their parents and show respect for their parents. And I have appointed men to these offices whose adult children are no longer in the church, or maybe never were in the church. Now, as you evaluate men and families for these offices, that ought to factor in, because not having our children in the church may well be a red flag of something else that we ought to steer away from. It may not. My two sons are in the church, but at their age, that's their decision. Now, if I had a person or a family who still had their children living at home and were disrespectful and didn't come to church, I'd have a hard time appointing that man, because they're still under his roof and should be under his control. But once they leave and become adults, God does give them free will. I've said, and I'm sure I wasn't the first person to say it, if perfect parents always had perfect kids, then we'd all be perfect, because God's the perfect parent. And we're not, are we? Because he gave us free will. So I do not think that it necessarily excludes a man to be considered for these offices if his adult children who have left the home are not faithful to the Lord. But they should still be faithful to him in terms of having respect and having a relationship with him that he could build on. Could this be a hindrance to this man as he counsels other people on parenting? Sure it could. Sure it could. But it doesn't seem to me to be implied as much as a wife and a divorce. So to me, faithful children probably connotates faithful to the parents as opposed to faithful to the Lord. If you take the more conservative view on that, I respect you immensely, and I don't think you'll go too far astray, but that's my best thinking on it. I open it up for any comments or questions anybody might have on that one. Steve?
I have one thought on the term children. It's my understanding that the Greek term is not specific as to number or to gender, or even if there is biological children.
Sure.
And so we might even consider that in a household where you have the older children who are out of the house, and you see maybe some of those are faithful to the Lord, perhaps that's an indicator you can look at. But I'm with you on this. I mean, we cannot place an impossible burden on the man. There comes a point when his children make their own decisions, and he's not in control of that. And if he were trying to be in control of that, we'd have some problems with that too. So.
If his rearing process, in the eyes of those that know him best, which would be the other people in the congregation, show poor choices in the rearing of his children, it could well be a signal of poor choices in the leading of the flock, and that might disqualify him. But it does not always do that, I guess is my opinion. I've said this, and I don't mind it being on the internet. My parents had two children, me and my sister Karen. Growing up, if you had asked me which one, if only one of us was going to be in the church, who would it be? It would have been her. As it's turned out, it's the opposite. Well, does that mean my parents did a poorer job raising her than they did me? No, and she was less challenging than I was. And I don't understand why it turned out that way. It just did. I'm sure there's reasons. I'm just not. If I was a physics teacher, I'd understand this better. But I'm just an evangelist. And that's way down the ladder from physics teacher. Anybody else care to make a comment? Yes, Pat.
Parents have grown children.
She said if the officer elder in this case has grown children, they get into a tussle with the law and it becomes a community scandal, should that man resign? I don't think necessarily he should. If he was not, they're grown children, they're adults, if he was not responsible for this tussle. It's a heartache, and I know it's happened, and people ask that question. Now, if the congregation felt he should, then he probably should, not because I think he's disqualified, but how do you lead a congregation that doesn't want to follow you? He would be ineffective. But I know of several cases where this has happened. I don't know that you have one in mind, and I'm sure you and I don't have the same one in mind. And the man, in one case, wanted to, or offered to resign, and the congregation asked him not to, and he didn't. Once they're adults and leave the home, I just think that falls on them. Falls on them. Excellent question. Doug?
You had mentioned that it could be a hindrance or a detriment, but it also could become a strength, because sometimes our greatest lessons that we learn are when we realize that we have done something wrong or we made a mistake and we figure out how to correct it or do it better.
Absolutely. He said it, these could be weaknesses, but it could be strengths. And that's absolutely true. And I'll even apply that to the divorce. I don't know that I think that person would be the best person to be an officer, but I tell people who have gone through divorces, you can minister to people in ways I can't. I mean, I intellectually know what to say, but I haven't gone through it. You've gone through it. Or maybe someone that comes into the church that has had a drinking problem. That's the guy to go help people that are struggling with it, because he or she understands that in ways maybe you and I don't. That's just using our strengths. So it can be a strength. It may or may not, however, be wise to put that person in the office. It's a judgment area, or God would have told us exactly what to do in every case. And I don't personally find that. Good point. Anybody else care to make a comment? This, I think, do I have another one? Yeah, that's only three. These, I think, are going to be great temptations for the church. Because it is getting increasingly hard to find men and families that meet these qualifications. And when that happens, the temptation is to lower the bar. And I suspect we're going to have numerous congregations in the next 10 or 15 years that are not going to have officers if the bar isn't lowered. And that hurts me. But I would rather us have congregations without officers than congregations with unqualified officers. I put apt to teach here. Sometimes I'm asked, how good do you have to be? Well, good enough that the congregation thinks you can teach. That's number one. And you need to be able to at least converse with people about the scriptures to show someone what they need to be saved. Do you have to be able to always give a 30-minute presentation that keeps everybody riveted? No. Some of the best elders and deacons I know, well, some of the we okay?
Yeah.
Okay. That hardly ever bothers me, except when I think somebody might be expiring when they're not singing. I guess it is. I'm riveted. Okay, Amy. I'm going to look over here. Otherwise, we'll need some paper towels. Okay. You know, it's amazing. This is an aside. When my kids were growing up, that stuff didn't faze me. It's with your kids. I worry about your kids more than I did mine. I guess I figured there'd plenty more where mine came from if I needed them. But I didn't need them. Oh, they're going to hear this. Okay. Where were we? Apt to teach. Thank you. Thank you. Some of the best elders I know aren't the most eloquent teachers, but they can get the point across. Now, sometimes I think we fudge on this a little bit and say, well, maybe they can't verbally teach, but then by example they teach. Well, that is an example, but I think here we're talking about the ability to also verbally. And when I tie that with what I see in Titus chapter 1, being able to convict or to handle the gainsayers, the false teachers, there has to be some verbal abilities there, not just example. But I don't think we're talking about charisma and eloquence. We're just talking about not being a novice, knowing the scriptures, and being able to articulate them. So, obviously, the better a person is at that, that can be an asset, a greater asset. But it doesn't have to be. You don't have to be the Billy Graham or whatever. In fact, I don't want you to be the Billy Graham. But I mean, in terms of oratory skills. Anybody want to make a comment on that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, John.
Man, help me be in church. We had a sixth grade education.
Yeah.
And he was country as they get him. But he was sincere. He knew that he believed.
John said the man, pardon me, I'll let you finish, but so they can hear. The one that was mostly responsible for leading him to the church had a sixth grade education, wasn't particularly eloquent, but he was terribly sincere. And we'd all rather hear somebody sincere than eloquent. Now, if you can have both, that's fine. Sometimes I'll run into a person who is an officer, and they'll just bemoan the fact that, well, I only went to the fifth grade or eighth grade, whatever it is, and you got to go to college. And I just chuckle, because graduating from college doesn't mean you're smart. It just doesn't. You may be, but it's a coincidence. And some of these men, no, really, it is. College ruins a lot of people because they're not very smart, unless they're physics teachers. But they have people skills. They have common sense, and they know the scriptures. And man, not only does that go a long way, that's it. That should be it. And I really appreciate them. So I don't care how far you went in school, but don't feel bad if you didn't go too far, and don't feel like you got a big head if you went a long ways, because it's totally irrelevant to me. Anybody else care to make Charles?
You comment about when
the ability to teach may fail and whether or not it's a lifetime appointment.
Okay, I will. And that would not only just apply to that, but to anything. He said, would I comment on when the ability to teach might fail? And are these officers lifetime appointments? Well, if we live long enough, all of these abilities are going to fail a little bit. I've seen sometimes people as they get older get more patient, but sometimes as we get older we get less patient and various things. I tend to, however, look at these as except in very extenuating circumstances, I think we should approach these as lifetime appointments. I don't see, Ed mentioned this yesterday, not about officers, but about he didn't find retirement in the scriptures. I don't find it either. Now, if a man got to the position, or maybe his wife, got to the position where their actions were being detrimental to the flock, then it might be time to ask them to step down. If, however, the person is simply failing in their capabilities but are not being detrimental to the flock, then I would personally like for us to be very tolerant of that and almost out of honor to them, not make them resign. Now, if a man starts losing it so that every time that we get together or when he's up here, he starts spouting out stuff he shouldn't, and then you've got to do something. I'll use my dad as an example here because he won't mind and I won't be stepping on any of your toes. The last 5 or 6 years of his life, he wasn't able to get in the pulpit. I think his mind wasn't too bad, but he couldn't put it to words. And my mom, for several years, wanted him to resign. And she even, I believe, talked to some of the people down at NICSA about that. And I think they showed some real wisdom. I don't even know for sure who all she talked to, but he wasn't hurting anything. And so as an honor to him, they said, let's just leave him in. She wanted him because she was finding it a little bit troublesome, maybe a tad embarrassing. I don't know. I don't want to put words in her mouth. And there have been people up here. I know I'm familiar with Dean Avenue and Pleasant Hill, where you've had older men that, could they do what they used to do? No. But not only in those cases that I found, they weren't hurting anything. I found them to be rather inspirational, that they were still wanting to do. And I don't know if they'd want me to mention names, but, well, I will, because they're old and they won't ever listen to the internet anyway. But he's dead now, but there was Ben Brady at Dean Avenue, and that was kind of a scenario like that. At Pleasant Hill now, you've got Carol Warren, and Carol can't do everything he used to do, but he could. His mind's still good, and I know he's thought about stepping down, and I know people have kind of urged him not to, and I think he's cool with that. But if they're harming the congregation, then I think they should. But this idea, well, I just turned 80, so I need to step down and let these young pups take it, I don't buy that. I think a white head or a shiny scalp is good for a congregation. When the Lord started Smart Road and we started meeting there, our oldest member was 54 or 5. And I would go places and people said, I wish our oldest member was 55 because their youngest member was 70. And I said, no, you don't, because we missed that what Ed was talking about last night. Now, 20 years later, we got some of them. You know, we're spread out. But, you know, you want the youth, but you want the others. So that's my comment on that, Charles, and that may not be your feeling on that, but that's the way I feel about it. And certainly resigning the office so you can go to Texas is not a good reason. Pardon me. I don't mind you going to Texas, but that's not a good reason for hanging it up, because we need you. That's the bottom line. We need you. We need you. Anybody want to comment on that? Becky?
At what point do outside family influences become a problem for an elder?
You want to hone that in a little bit more for me?
Well, when an elder has problems in the family, whether the health of a spouse or problems with a child or something of that nature, when does that become a problem for the elder performing his duty?
Okay, if by problem with the child you mean rebelliousness or sinfulness?
Anything.
Well, I make a distinction. If I'm an elder and I have a child under my roof that I'm responsible for and they become rebellious, then I think that does reflect on me and I would be more inclined to step aside. If my child became ill, that's quite a different matter that doesn't have spiritual connotations. If a wife became ill, I don't think that has spiritual connotations, so I would not ask that man to step aside. Now, if he said, I simply can't function because I have to spend so much time with my cancer-stricken wife, I would respect his wishes. And I have known of some men who, I'm thinking of one in particular, who was an elder, his children and his health became issues. He resigned, and then several years ago, the congregation asked him, and he came back in after those things had subsided. And if I mentioned his name, you would all know him, and there's no need for me to mention that name because it's none of our business, but it can't happen. Those are case-by-case things, but if it's an illness or a non-spiritual thing, I don't think the man is called upon to resign unless he just feels he has to. Anybody else care to make a comment on any of this or on any of the other qualifications that I just kind of went over and, well, I just read? Steve?
John, just one quick question on the faithful children part.
Yes, sir.
I guess I always looked at or heard of this thought on a more conservative level, that then they have baptized believing children, whether they be in the home or outside of the home. Have you ever appointed an elder, or have you seen a situation where an elder was appointed where maybe he had a couple older children that were out of the home, some children living in the home that were attending services, but the ones at home were not baptized yet, the ones that were outside of the home had never been baptized either, no faithful children to the Lord? Have you ever seen that?
Okay, I'm trying to figure out how I can add three or four more variables into your question. I have never appointed anyone that I can recall in that specific situation. Having said that, I've already said if the children are out of the home, I think that parent is no longer scripturally accountable for them in the same way that he is under their roof. So that would not be, shall I call it, a deal killer for me, unless his parenting skills obviously showed he didn't know how to teach them and so forth. Then you can make the case, if your children aren't Christian, you did something wrong. But I think that can be, I don't make that a rule. But I have seen also some men appointed to the offices when their children were young. We would say they weren't even to the age of accountability. I'm not sure if that's what you had in mind or not.
I made that way complicated, I guess.
Thank you.
The simple question was, have you ever seen appointed an elder who has not led someone that dwelt in his house, that was his child, to the Lord?
Yes. Me. The first time I went in as an elder, the boys, and I'm going to be plus or minus a year, were 10 and 7. Now, does that make it right? No. It just means I know of someone, and I know of numerous ones. And the congregation felt, I guess they felt I was ready, and Donna and I felt I was ready. I would, however, caution us that irregardless of how ready they appear, let's be careful and not put families in an unfortunate situation of they need to be dealing with their children, and we're asking them to be gone two or three nights a week. So I'm not going to say it was wise in my case, but I know of numerous cases where that has happened. I was counseling a man that went in, and he had children that were teenagers and some that were in grade school, and he had four kids, if I remember right. I was concerned that it would be unfair to his family. Not that he wasn't qualified, he'd just be unfair. So we talked about it, and I never will forget what this man said that convinced me he was ready. He said, my children need to see me serving the Lord. He was looking at it as a teaching opportunity to teach his kids how the Lord comes first. Now, not everyone can handle it that well, because it can take you away. And I've seen families, maybe their children have suffered because dad was out solving everybody else's, trying to solve every other else's problem. I talked to somebody this week who told me that, I think he might have been an officer at the time, I'm not sure, but we were just visiting, and he said, I used to spend a lot of time with this other young brother, not related to him, to the point that I neglected my family. And he said, in hindsight, I wouldn't do that again. So, those are things to consider. Is that close to your question? Okay. Marvin.
Do you see a parallel between God pointing people at an age and asking them to resign at a certain age in the Old Testament?
To what we should do now?
We should do.
You're talking about the priests, like from 30 to 50 or whatever. Marvin's question is, in the Old Testament, a priest might start at, and I get different numbers, but 25, 30, and might serve until they're 50. Marvin says, do I see a parallel between that and the New Testament? No, I don't.
Why did you have them quit?
I don't know. He said, why then did he have them quit? I guess I can't answer that. I can suppose it may have been to make sure the younger ones got an opportunity, because there was only so much work for the priests to do. Today, I don't see that as a limiting factor. There is no end to the work for our elders and deacons to do. That's point number one. And they probably didn't live, sometimes on average, all that long under some of the Old Testament times. I mean, I know we think of Methuselah and all these people, but a lot of them didn't live very long. But I have never made a connection between the two in terms of, well, we ought to resign from office when we hit 50 or 60. I'd rather see us go in about that age, personally. But we're not given an age, so if you went in as an elder at 30 and were ready, that's fine. I think I was 35, and that doesn't mean I was ready. That's just the way it worked. But in general, I would counsel a little older to be better. It worked for us in that our children are still in the church, but it doesn't mean I was the best father that I could have been. Well, I wasn't. That's the end of that. Anybody want to comment on Marvin's question? I have never made a, that's a pattern that we ought to follow, but
I've always felt that when you're unable to do the work of the office, then you ought to resign.
Marvin says he's always felt that when you're unable to do the work, you ought to resign. And people feel that way, and I respect that, and I don't want to talk them out of it. The question I thought I had is, should we, well, I took it to be, Charles's question is, should we ask them to step aside? But unless you've got some real significant mental and emotional problems, I just don't want to lose your productivity all the way up into your 60s, 70s, and 80s, and as long as you got it together. Dean?
Does anybody know when the high priest was supposed to step down under the law of Moses?
I don't know of a specific age. You got what? When he died? Okay.
So, if you want to take the Old Testament as some example, we've got both priests and the high priest stayed in until he died.
So. Yeah. And just so you ladies don't feel unscathed, this is an opinion, but I hear sometimes some of you ladies that have got a lot of wealth of experience and wisdom kind of saying, well, I've taught for a long time, it's time for these younger ladies to take over. Well, I'm all for getting the younger ladies to take their turns, but I'm not at all in favor of you guys turning it over, because you have so much to offer. Now, my mom finally got to the point where she did quit, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and I understood. She just couldn't put her thoughts together and she wasn't as patient. But just because there are young people coming up to take your place doesn't mean you step aside. It just means we got more people to pull the wagon and the wagon can now be bigger. So we're not, it's not just men that I don't think should retire from the Lord's work. It's the ladies too. Anybody else? I'm not going to go to my next set. I may talk some other questions if you don't have any others. This took longer than I thought, but that's okay because we wanted it to, or you wanted it to. Charles?
The only thing that I was thinking about with that, not that it wouldn't be useful, but that somebody going into the office would have to go through the very cautious, appropriately very cautious, not just seeking the honor of it. And then if they remain in the office non-functioning for the honor of it, it seems to be a conflict in that. They could be extremely useful to the congregation, even if they weren't, you're not losing them. If they resign the office, you're not losing them from the congregation. Plenty of capability, plenty of influence and so forth. But if they're not able to perform the function of the office, they're holding on to the honor. Look at that,
look down on that as a concern
if you're going into the office for that.
Okay, if I understood you right, what I had said is you shouldn't go into the office for the honor of the office. And then I'm kind of saying, well, maybe someone should stay in it for the honor of the office. Is that the disconnect? You're kind of, well, I understand what you're saying, but to me that's totally different because in the first case, the person's wanting the honor for themselves. In the second case, it's the congregation giving the honor to that person. And that makes the night and day for me. But if a man just wanted to hold on to it when he couldn't do the job because he wanted the prestige, then that's equally wrong on either end of the scale. That man's got a problem. And I imagine it's happened. I've seen wives of elders not want their husbands to retire or quit because they thought they'd lose influence in the congregation. Oh, that reminds me. I have gotten a half a dozen questions, mostly from ladies, wanting me to talk about how do you handle women when they talk too much and usurp authority in the assembly. So we're going to talk about it. Not today, but one of these days. Probably tomorrow. So it's not something I'm dying to talk about, but there's enough interest, and I find it interesting. It seems to be women more upset about this than men, which may be a bad commentary on the men, but be that as it may. Steve,
would you appoint a man to the office who had several grown children out of the home, all of whom had been baptized, but all of whom were riot?
Would I appoint a man who's had baptized children who have now left the home and they were all accused of riot and unruly? I don't think I could technically disqualify him, but in a case like that, I would look very, very closely to make sure there wasn't something in his parenting approach that might be a hindrance to the congregation. We didn't mention this, but obviously I hope you all understand children. I don't take that to be a plurality. He has to have children. Steve touched on that. And they could be adopted. The qualification of these officers isn't being able to biologically sire children. It's having the experience of raising them in the Lord. But one of the main reasons I don't take children there to be plural is in Ephesians chapter 6, it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. So if you're an only child, you don't have to? No, that's not the tenor of that. Now, I kind of think multiple kids have some advantages, but my sister was an only child and it worked out. Anybody else want to make a comment or ask a question? I'm sorry. Who? You or Butch?
No, me. John.
Oh, John?
I speak to Butch. Okay. Our children be subject, I believe, is the guideline that the Lord has provided us. And product, everybody views that. And they come to their decision. by seeing what they do. And that continues until they leave your household.
I think there is a real accountability for our children as long as they're under our roof. And this transcends officers. But I've had parents say they've had their children, they may be 28, living under their roof and don't come to church. Well, I don't have a 28-year-old or 25-year-old under my roof. But if I did, they'd either come to church or they wouldn't be under my roof. That's the end of that. Now, you make your own choices. But I think I have seen parents, and I don't want to tread on Charles's topic, I have seen parents out of love enable their children in directions they shouldn't be enabling them. It's kind of like that, and I don't think I've used it, I know I haven't used it this week. A parent said, I can't talk to my child because every time we try to talk, they go into their room and they slam the door shut and lock the door. Well, if that was my kid, when they came home from school the next day, there wouldn't be a door there. Okay, and that's the end of that. Now, if they want to have their own house and put a lock on their door and keep me out, that's fine. But if they're in my house, I can go in. And I don't want you to think that I had these great... My boys were better than I was growing up. I mean, that's not even close. Not even close. So I salute them. Anybody else have a comment you would like to make on this general area of qualifications? Kimber? Sure. If the congregation can't look up to the man with respect and his family, then he shouldn't be considered. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. Because he won't be effective. That's just a fact. But we need godly men and women who will help us fill these roles. I believe the great challenge for the church is not more evangelists, it's more elders. And we have probably made an error. I'll get you, Colleen, because I want to hear what you have to say. We have probably made an error in honoring our evangelists more than we should and not honoring our elders as much as we should. There's no question in my mind that what I just said is true. And we raise a generation who thinks if they want to be honored in the church, they have to be evangelists. Colleen? Yes. Comment was, we need to hold these qualifications in high esteem, but nobody's perfect. And that's a valid statement. If I took every one of these qualifications to the nth degree, the only person qualified would be Jesus. Having said that, I don't want to take any of these qualifications and reduce them in order to fill the slots. The most difficult time and one of the most trepidatious times I have found for a congregation is when you have no elders and you're trying to put elders in, because the congregation has no reference point. If you have two or three elders and you're adding one, they have a much higher comfort factor because at least this one guy is probably not going to totally tear everything up. But when you got none and you go to two or three, that's real stressful. But that's how you get new congregations, and that's how it grows, so it's got to be done. And I once had someone tell me, we almost sometimes know each other too well. And I don't really believe that, but I know what they were saying, because we see each other's warts. And sometimes we just got to assimilate how significant a wart that is. We got about 3 minutes. Becky and then Dwayne.
One thing that most people tend to forget is that most of the qualifications that are listed there apply to most Christians.
Absolutely. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, the only two that we shouldn't all strive for are the marriage and the kids. And those are good things to strive for, but the rest of them are just exemplary Christians. Doug. I'm sorry, Dwayne. Sorry. I had a senior moment.
You haven't touched on one qualification I was wondering about is how you go about finding out if they have a good reputation with outsiders.
Dwayne says, well, how do you find out if they have good reputation with outsiders? Well, it's been my experience that if they don't, there's probably going to be someone in the congregation that knows it. But I don't just take their word for it. I had a case a few years ago where someone said, well, you go check with the merchants or whatever, and you'll find out. Well, that's touchy, because if you go in and say, you know, is Dwayne really a scallywag? Well, the guy may just not like you, and he may say yes. But you can put your ear to the ground and find out, especially in a smaller community. That tends to be a bigger problem. But usually the members know that. Now, above reproach doesn't mean that the person can't have something against you. It means having some legitimate thing against you. I mean, we've all got someone that doesn't like us that's going to say bad things about us. But is it legitimate? Does it stick? But you can sometimes go around and ask. But you do have to be delicate about that. Because well, some guy may just not like the person.
I just don't see how it's done in a place like where we live.
Well, in the bigger urban areas, it's probably not as easy to do, and dare I say, maybe not as, it's not less important, but in a small community, everybody knows what everybody does, and word travels in Anaheim or Long Beach or wherever. Nobody knows what anybody does, and nobody cares. Now, I'm being facetious when I say that, but it's different. It's different than a small town. Doug?
I was just going to say, it's important to remember that they were both very wise, very spiritual, very excellent men. Peter was qualified to be an elder of all of us.
Yeah, and it may have been the domestic issue. I don't know. It may have been. You know, in the New Testament, there's lots of good examples, but things were done different. Things could be done differently. I mean, Paul, on his first journey, he goes through these towns, turns around, a few weeks or months later, he appoints elders. Well, it doesn't happen that fast. But these people knew each other. They were grounded in the synagogues. There was the spiritual gifts. It takes longer now, and it should, and it should. But boy, When a man comes to me and says, I want to strive for it, help me, that's just music to my ears. I just wish I had a better retort. I apologize a little bit because I didn't really cover a lot of new material, and I gave you quite a bit of time for discussion today. I don't apologize because I didn't want to hear you, but we want to be sensitive to covering material and not just having a think. But we hadn't even touched on these qualifications, and it sounded like there was some desire to touch on some of them, so I set today aside for that. Okay, if you have any more questions, I'll be here at 1 o'clock tomorrow.